Hi, everyone. This is Emmy Laiha. Again, I'm in EPA's headquarters office in the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, or FFRRO for short. I want to thank everyone for joining us today for the Performance Measures and Environmental Indicators webinar. This was developed between both FFRRO and OSREDI, the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation Office, and we're really happy to be bringing this webinar for a bigger than EPA viewing, where all our partners can join in and learn more about environmental indicators. So just clicking through my slides here, one moment, so I can get the hang of it. There we go. All right, so jumping right into it, here's a quick overview of what we're going to be talking about today. We'll look at performance measures and targets, specifically how we track those measures. Then we'll see how those items relate to environmental indicators for human exposure and groundwater migration. We'll talk about a number of CERCLA components and how those are interrelated and are, affected and affect environmental indicators. And we'll round it out with some guidance and tools to help you at your sites when you're trying to figure out what your environmental indicator status should be. So why don't we go ahead and get into it, starting with performance measures and targets. And so I'm going to pause for a second. I get excited, and I know I can speak a bit quickly. So feel free to, if I'm going too fast, to type in the Q&A box to slow down, and I'll try and take a breath and take it a little bit slower. But I do get excited when talking about these topics. So, okay, back to our slides on performance measures and targets. We're going to talk about GPRA. That's the Government Performance and Results Act. We'll talk about how this affects what EPA does with its targets and measures, and then we'll get into our Superfund environmental indicators. So GPRA originated in 1993, and it addresses all federal agencies. Again, GPRA is the Government Performance and Results Act, and basically this was passed during a time of government reinvention. We were trying to promote government performance and also increase public confidence in what the government was doing. So a pretty high bar to set. It addresses all federal agencies, and it's really getting at better planning and reporting of what the government is doing. So the reform program performance was going to be done by setting performance goals or program goals, measuring against those goals of what our actual performance is, and then publicly reporting on that progress. So there are three main elements associated with this. First, doing five-year strategic plans. That would be complemented by annual performance plans and then annual reports where we say, are we meeting our goals or how are we doing in meeting our goals? So GPRA, again, passed in 1993, was updated in 2010 with the GPRA Modernization Act, and this required each agency to develop and publish a strategic plan. So beyond having a strategic plan, it's now a matter of making sure that that is published and basically publicly accessible. With EPA's strategic plan, it really set the foundation for the agency's planning and budgeting process, and it helps us establish quantifiable goals. Can we actually measure progress and measure how we're doing over that five-year horizon? So EPA's current strategic plan covers fiscal year 2018 through 2022, and it's published every 4 years. Within that plan, there is a specific goal to revitalize land and prevent contamination. So the Superfund program, all the cleanup we do under Superfund really helps to move this goal forward to make sure we're achieving sufficient progress. So let's look specifically at the six performance measures that the Superfund remedial program tracks. And again, this is to help demonstrate our progress in achieving specific environmental results. These measures are important because they are reported to Congress annually. So we set these goals, we measure them, and then we report on them, not only so the public is aware, but directly report them to Congress. And each year, through EPA's congressional justification, the Superfund program commits to accomplishing certain tasks that help promote these measures. So there's a lot of strategic planning going on. It's very important for planning out how much money EPA is going to request to help get to this work that needs to be done on an annual basis. So very, very important there. Let's look more closely at what these six performance measures are. So on the table on your screen, they're listed out. The ones highlighted in blue are our environmental indicators, which we're going to spend a lot of time talking about today. But let's look at some of the other ones that are also reported back to Congress. We have our remedial site assessments completed, human exposures under control, and that's when there are no unacceptable complete exposure pathways across a site, and you can consider the use of engineered barriers and institutional controls. More on that in just a minute. We also have site-wide ready for anticipated use, or SWARU for short, and that's when all cleanup goals have been achieved at a site so that there's no unacceptable risks. We'll touch on that a bit more as well. Another performance measure is remedial action project completion. That's when all construction activities and final inspection are complete at a site and you have your remedial action completion report finalized. The groundwater migration under control environmental indicator, which talks about when all your groundwater plumes have been delineated, you fully know what's going on, monitoring is in place, migration of that contaminated groundwater is stable, and there's no unacceptable discharges to surface water. So that was a mouthful, but again, we're going to break down the groundwater EI as well in a, later on in the presentation. And last performance measure is CC, or construction completion. That's when all remedies that are documented in site cleanup decision documents have completed physical instruction and have a pre-final inspection and a preliminary closeout report. There's more information on that in your participant manuals. Hopefully all of you were able to download that so you can follow along or take notes as we're going through today's presentation. So these are the measures that we're looking at. How do we track them? EPA puts all of its planning information into SEMS. That's the Superfund Enterprise Management System. It's a source for our site activity data, records, support documentation. It's where we house all this very, very important information. It's also a useful tool because program staff and managers can plan and track program activities based on the information in SEMS. And it's also a useful tool for regional and headquarters staff who are monitoring the progress each region is making in achieving our annual performance goals that are described in the strategic plan. So it's really helpful to avoid some of those fire drills where someone from headquarters is asking you to give them all the site data and they need it by, you know, 2 hours or by end of day. By having this information uploaded in SEMS, it really helps address that issue or that situation because there's a one-house shop to get all of that data. So that's why it's so critical to have the accurate information uploaded into SEMS for EPA RPMs managing their sites and that is updated in a timely fashion so you can avoid some of those fire drills. So just something to keep in mind. So speaking of EPA headquarters, I want to take a minute to talk about the EPA Superfund Task Force. This was established in May of 2017 to develop recommendations to help expedite cleanup and remediation, among other goals. But in July of 2017, the Superfund Task Force report was issued, and there was a recommendation in there that was looking to target National Priority List, NPL, sites that are not showing sufficient progress towards site completion, cleanup and completion, excuse me. And a part of that recommendation was to determine any site where human exposure is not under control and prioritize affecting control. So suddenly this measure that we've been measuring for years was really thrust into the spotlight because the task force really wanted to make sure that if there were human exposures occurring, that those were prioritized and addressed as quickly as possible. But there was suddenly this larger emphasis on this measure that you know, really didn't get as much national attention before headquarters attention. So suddenly regions are hearing a lot more questions. Other federal agencies who are in charge of cleanup at their sites are also getting questions. Hey, what's going on with human exposures at your site? It's been not under control for 10 plus years. What are we going to do about this? So it really started that conversation around environmental indicators in a more national sense, and we've been engaging in those conversations since then. So what did this mean? What other impacts did this have? In response to that recommendation, EPA launched the Superfund Human Exposure Dashboard. You can see a snippet of that website on your screen now. And this is publicly accessible, so any member of the public can go to this website and check on their environmental indicator status for human exposure for their site. So here in this national review, this was a clip taken from mid-July. I believe the numbers are still up to date, but you can see there's quite a number of sites, over 1,500, that are under control. But then we have a smaller amount that are human exposure not under control, around 121, and then insufficient data at 172. And we'll talk more exactly about what those categories mean, but the whole point of this dashboard was to give the public the ability to understand, is there a risk of human exposures at these sites? Particularly if they live near these sites, they will want to better understand what's happening. So along with this pie chart, there's also a table shown on your screen now that for the sites that had insufficient data or human exposures not under control, you can see, let me get my little arrow here, that and these are hyperlinked, the statuses. So if you were to be on this website and actually clicked on that status, you would have a justification paragraph come up. And that is supposed to give the larger description or explanation as to why that site has that environmental indicator status. So again, another very important reason to have all your information up to date in SEMS, because this is taken from SEMS. EPA has environmental indicator work group. They're working with RPMs and their managers to develop these justification paragraphs so that they can be uploaded. And we look at these annually. So having up-to-date information in SEMS, very, very important, particularly when this is public-facing. Because if it's not clear what's going on, you're going to get a lot of questions. You might strike up a lot of concern in the public. So you want to be able to tell the whole story as to what's happening at the site in relation to human exposures. All right. So we've talked a bit about performance measures, why we have them, how we track them. But now I want to switch gears and talk more about environmental indicators. Why do we have environmental indicators? Well, they're really intended to be simple measures that provide a more practical way of measuring progress, because we can't measure everything, right? That's too much data. So what can we measure? Environmental indicators are designed to communicate the tangible progress made in protecting human health and the environment, with a real focus on bringing human exposure and contaminated groundwater migration under control. So these were the two data points, I guess you could call them, that we're tracking to really be able to measure, are we making sufficient progress? Another thing to keep in mind that I'll get into more detail later is that environmental indicator determinations are made on a site-wide basis. And so we'll break that down moving forward, but just keep that in mind. All OUs in a site need to be considered when you're making your EI determinations. So let's get into human exposure determinations. If we all want our sites to have human exposures under control. So your current human exposure under control status happens when you have sufficient information to make a determination, you have enough data to pull from to know if exposures are happening, and with that data you can confirm that there are currently no unacceptable complete exposure pathways. So keep in mind, this can rely on engineered barriers or institutional controls in making this determination. It's not the same thing as having a Superfund remedy fully implemented. You're really just looking at the exposure pathways and determining if they're complete. If you have a site that has been human exposures under control, for maybe it's been that status for a while, but now there's new information on either exposure pathways or contaminant sources, that may mean you have to change your human exposure from under control to not under control. I know that idea is a little hard for some people to understand, that it's a switch. It can be turned on and off. The appropriate requirements have to be met in order to be able to say, yes, my human exposures are under control at a site. So what are the human exposure determination categories? They're up on your screen now in this summary table. Just as a quick reference, for me, when I was first trying to get a handle on environmental indicators, the acronyms alone had me entirely confused. I'm like, what HEPR? I don't know what that stands for. And I could not find any document that had a quick reference table. So we're providing it for you here. Hopefully you'll find it helpful to know what these acronyms mean. For example, if you're looking at a SEMS report, or talking with someone who's using a SEMS report and they're using acronyms you don't understand, well, that's not going to be very helpful. So the first acronym we're going to look at is HEID. That's when you have insufficient data to determine human exposure control status for your site. We have HENC, current human exposure not under control. HEUC, current human exposure under control, where we want all our sites to get to at least that point. But there's actually three levels of under control. We have HEUC. The next step would be HEPR, and that's when you also have protective remedies in place. And then the final one, which we ultimately want all our sites to get to, is HHPA. That's when you have all your current human exposures under control and you've achieved long-term human health protection across your site. For those last two, if you're looking to get a designation of site-wide ready for anticipated use, or SWARU, your EI status for human exposures needs to be HEPR or PA. You either need to have that protective remedy in place or have achieved human health protection in the long term. So we'll talk more about that when we talk about SWARU, but just wanted to get that on your radar now. If you want more information, the 2008 EI guidance is very helpful. This was taken from Table 4-1 of that guidance. So let's go through these more in more detail. We have insufficient data to determine human exposure, HEID. So that's pretty clear what that means, right? You don't have enough information to determine if there is a potential for people to be exposed to contamination. Typically, this means you don't fully understand all the potential exposure pathways. They haven't been identified yet. You don't fully understand your conceptual site model. Maybe you're still collecting data to develop that model, but there's some big question marks related to the site. It may also apply to sites where new information has called into question the potential for a new exposure pathway. And also, when you're writing those justifications that I mentioned EPA RPMs are responsible for putting into STEMS, it's important to identify a date when sufficient data will be collected to make a determination. Maybe you're waiting on a groundwater monitoring report. Maybe you're waiting on studies related to a five-year review or completion of an RIFS or whatever it may be. You should have a sense of when sufficient data has been collected so you can make that make that determination. Okay, so now, and we're going to participate in an interactive poll. This is a apply your understanding slide. So what's going to happen is I'm going to lay out a scenario, and then you'll have multiple choice answers. You can see them, I believe, in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, and you'll be able to vote on what you think the answer is, and then we can discuss through the Q&A box. So here's the scenario. Imagine that you have soil and groundwater samples that have been collected at Superfund Site X as part of the remedial investigation. Data suggests that there are no existing pathways for human exposure. Given that information, what is your human exposure status determination? So go ahead and select the answer from the multiple choice bubble available to you. We'll give people a few seconds to get their answer in.
And Emmy, I can see some of those responses coming in now. I'll just remind those of you who are participating in groups, you'll have to talk it out amongst yourselves there and select one answer that represents your entire group. Okay. So I'm getting a sense that the responses are coming in, but they seem to be pretty stable around the distribution of responses. So it looks like, from my view, Emmy, that three-quarters of the audience believe that this is an HEUC, current human exposure under control. But about a quarter of the audience thinks that it could be HEID, where it's insufficient data to determine it. And then just a few others think that it could possibly be HHPA, where the current human exposure under control and long-term human health protection is achieved.
All right. So let's talk about these answers. I guess I'll start by saying there it's not black and white. These questions could have a lot of it depends or what if, but let's look at the first part of this poll. So you could have said that human exposures are under control because you have enough information to say there's no existing pathways for human exposure based on the data you have. So one thing I want to clarify, you don't necessarily need to have a full remedial investigation and feasibility study done for your site to wait and say you have sufficient information to make a determination. Usually you don't have the luxury of having that much data before you're making an EI determination for your site. if you said that it is, what else do we have, insufficient data, that would be fair. We're saying the data suggests. So you might read that to say, okay, it suggests, but is there more data we need to collect? Are there other pathways we're unaware of? So I would say, given your site-specific circumstances, human exposure, insufficient data might be a reasonable answer as well. Okay, so let's look at the second part of this question. More recent data suggests that vapor intrusion may be occurring in on-site buildings at your site. Based on that information, what is your updated human exposure status? We'll give people a few seconds to get their votes in. Okay, so it looks like we still have a few more votes coming in.
Mm-hmm. But I do think that trend sort of shifted more, right? From what I'm seeing, Emmy, it looks like now we've got about two-thirds of the audience saying this is probably HEID, where it's insufficient data. But you still have a significant chunk of the audience, about a third, who believe that it is HENC, where the current human exposure is not under control.
Right. All right, so let's talk about these answers. Again, I think you could justify either human exposure is not under control or insufficient data. It really depends into more of the specifics for the site. But if you know, you already have some data saying that there's vapor intrusion, there's unacceptable levels of risk in these buildings due to a vapor intrusion pathway. If you want to say human exposures are not under control, I would say you could justify that. However, the may wording can also be justified for insufficient data. You could say we just don't have enough information yet to know if it's a complete exposure pathway, so we're going to study it more and plan to have enough sufficient data, you know, in X month and year or whatever the appropriate timing would be. So, again, I would say you could argue for either one of those as being the correct determination for your site. You'd need a little bit more site-specific information. But I think we're all in agreement that you're definitely not under control or any level of under control given this scenario. Did any other questions or comments come in, Jean?
So I don't see any comments or any clarifying statements about that.
Okay, perfect. We'll have a couple more of these throughout the webinar, so there'll be a chance to provide your insights if you would like on those future ones. All right, so let's get back to our slides. Here we go. Okay, so let's talk about current human exposure not under control, HENC. So this means that site data indicates there's unacceptable exposure pathways that are present and have not yet been controlled, mitigated, or eliminated. So this can typically include sites where response actions are underway but not yet complete. I want to emphasize again, if you have a site that has multiple OUs, a single OU can keep the site's status as not under control. So let's say you have a large site, there's 100 OUs in that site, and 99 of them are under control. There's one that is not. You have a complete exposure pathway that has not been addressed or mitigated in any way. So your EI determination for that site would be human exposure is not under control. Keep in mind in your justification language that you'll upload into SEMS as an EPA RPM, or maybe you'll work with other team members if you're dealing with federal facility sites or something like that, you can provide that narrative. Say, out of these 100 OUs, 99 are under control. This one site has these challenges, and we're planning to address it by X time. If you need more information on how you can write these justification paragraphs, those are going to be covered at the very end of the webinar in the SPIM manual, the Superfund implementation. The acronym escapes me, but that's why I have a slide for it at the end and the link to it as well in your participant manual where sample text is provided. So you can take that sample text and adjust it so it fits the specifics of your site to have a fully descriptive justification. Going back to the slide, as I mentioned, you want to know when you're going to have not only sufficient data, but in this case, when you're actually going to say that human exposures are under control, when is the planned time for that? Because there's such national attention on this in the current time. And I mean, that's the whole point. We don't want human exposures happening at our Superfund sites. We want to protect human health and the environment. So knowing that date and identifying it is going to be very important. So with your next, before we go to the next determination, we have another apply your understanding. So now I think everyone has the hang of how these go. I'm going to go over the scenario and then you'll be able to vote. So this deals with Superfund Site Y, where it was determined to have unacceptable levels of groundwater contamination. In response to that, bottled water is being provided to all impacted residents. No other exposure pathways have been identified. So in this case, keep in mind that a groundwater remedy has not yet been implemented. So this is early in the process. Given this scenario, is your human exposure under control? Lots of votes coming in. We'll give it a few seconds so everyone can get their thoughts included. Okay, so it seems like the numbers have slowed down. The majority of people who responded said no, in this scenario, human exposure is not under control. So I think you could argue for that. My initial reaction to reading this scenario was to say, oh, there's no other exposure pathways except for drinking water. That's being provided to residents through the bottled water. So I would say you could argue that it is under control based on that information. But we have a number of people who just said no. It's not under control. I need to add a why so I can understand that better, because I want to know what people were thinking.
So here's what several people have chimed in with why they answered no. And one participant mentioned that if you have a poor community, they actually may wind up selling that bottled water and then drinking the water from the tap, even though you've told them that it's unacceptable to do so. And then they also chimed in and said, look, even if you give them bottled drinking water, they're still taking showers and baths in that water in their residence, so they still have an exposure there. And what another participant basically chimed in and said, look, bottled water or not, that does nothing to change the pathway. The exposure pathway still exists regardless if you give them an alternative.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear that insight as to what people were thinking. And I think all of those are valid given what the impacted residents are. What are the demographics of that community? And I think it's also fair to say, as someone mentioned, if that pathway is there, people can still turn on the tap. They can still jump in the shower and have that contaminated water, you know, have contact with that contaminated water. Is the exposure pathway really been mitigated and fully addressed? This is not a clear yes or no answer, and I think it's valid. As long as you can provide sufficient justification with what environmental indicator status you would make for your site for human exposures. If you know residents are selling the bottled water and drinking from the tap, or you can say, we know that people are showering and are still being exposed to this contamination, the pathway hasn't been addressed. That, to me, makes perfect sense to say, no, human exposures are not under control at this site. All right, did any other thoughts or comments come in, Jean?
We had one other comment just mentioning that people could also be gardening and eating the vegetables, and then if they're watering with that water, they're still getting exposed as well.
Okay. So, yeah, a lot of different aspects coming into there. And it really comes down to site specifics. Do people have access to the water? Are people taking water from wells? Are there no wells or prohibition in putting wells in? A lot of different circumstances to look at. But I like that people are thinking outside the box on all of those what ifs for their site. That's great. All right, let's keep going with our human exposure. Now we're going to talk about current human exposure under control. So that's the first step where we want our sites to get to. So assessments indicate that there's no unacceptable complete human exposure pathways for the status. The site is under control for current conditions site-wide. And at the current human exposure under control sites, you typically have sites that have not yet attained construction completion. The remedy might still be implemented with controls in place to prevent exposure. Then we're getting to the next levels of current human exposures under control, is the next one being when you have also protective remedies in place, HEPR. So data will indicate that there are currently no unacceptable complete human exposure pathways. You have the site under control site-wide, and that all physical construction is complete, systems are operating as intended, and institutional controls are in place and effective. Very important that your ICs actually be effective, because if they're not effective, then you might have exposures happening at your site. Then the last human exposure status, where we want all our sites to eventually get to, is current human exposure under control and long-term human health protection achieved, HHPA. So you'll have the same, you know, data showing that there's no complete exposure pathways, it's under control across your site, you've reached construction completion, and there's no ongoing remedial action to address, be it soil, groundwater, surface water, what have you, and that you've achieved all the restoration levels for those media. So essentially, you've implemented your remedy fully, and you've achieved all your cleanup levels for this status. So, of course, we want all our sites to get to that point. So if you're trying to figure out, okay, there's these categories, here's my site information, how am I supposed to figure out what my EID status should be? There is a helpful chart. This is included in your participant manual and in the EI guidance. You're not intended to read this slide. We're going to go over the flow chart and the more user-friendly slides on the next page. So let's go through this together, through the worksheet, essentially. So if you have a site and you're trying to figure out what your environmental indicator should be, you're going to start by asking this question one. Is there sufficient information to make an evaluation on human exposures? If not, then you have insufficient data. If yes, you go to question two. I think I have a little arrow I can help with. Here we go. You would go to question two, and you ask, have all long-term human exposure-related cleanup goals been met for the entire site? If yes, great, then you're at current human exposures under control and long-term protection achieved. If not, we go to question three, where you ask, are there complete human exposure pathways between your contaminated media and human receptors such that human exposures can reasonably be expected? If yes, we'll go to step four. If not, you would skip to step five. So let's skip to step four on the next slide, where you would ask, are there actual or reasonably anticipated human exposures associated with the complete pathways within acceptable limits under current conditions? If not, if they're not within acceptable limits and exposures could potentially happen, then you would say, well, human exposures are not under control over here in the red box. If you would say yes to that question, then you would come to question number five, where you ask, is the site construction complete? Is the remedy operating as intended, and are the engineering and institutional controls, if needed, in place, working and effective? So if all those criteria are met, then you've done it. You have current human exposures under control, and your protective remedies are in place. And you're going to keep implementing that long-term remedy until you can get to human health, long-term human health protection achieved. If you've only met some of those, say, for example, you're only at construction complete, you can't say that you've met all the criteria, then you would say current human exposures are under control. So that's more in the short term. All right. So I'd like to continue straight into groundwater unless any questions have come in specific to human exposures.
Nope, we can go ahead and move on.
Okay. So continuing on to the migration of contaminated groundwater under control, EI. So this EI typically documents if you have groundwater contamination that is at below protective risk-based levels, or if you don't, if the contaminated groundwater plumes are stabilized, that there's no unacceptable discharge to surface water, and that monitoring is in place to ensure that that affected area of contaminated groundwater stays within its original boundaries, isn't migrating away and changing shape or size. So before we get into all the details, we have one more interactive poll and another apply your understanding slide. So here we have Superfund Site Z, where contaminated groundwater has been found above acceptable risk levels. A remedy has been selected for the site. There's a pump and treat remedy that is ongoing. And we have institutional controls in place. Recent data confirms that there's no surface discharge to impacted water bodies. So given all of this information, would you say that your groundwater migration is under control? We see the answers coming in. We'll give people a few seconds to get their votes. Okay, so we have a majority of respondents who said that yes, groundwater migration is under control given this scenario. A few who said no, it is not, and then a few who were unsure. Do we have any comments come in?
Yeah, we do. Actually, there's a bunch of them coming in now, and essentially a lot of them are basically saying it really depends. Has containment been demonstrated? Because you really don't know for sure that the contamination isn't migrating wherever it is in the groundwater. It could be going way beyond the surface water discharge point and coming off somewhere else. And they're, again, even clarifying that that plume could be diving or migrating laterally. So just because we haven't found it in one place doesn't mean that it's not moving somewhere else.
Great. Those are great comments from people who put that in. I think that's the great catch here. Like, yes, there's a lot of things we're looking for. There's a remedy in place. The data we have suggests that there aren't discharges happening to surface water. That's good. We have ICs. But is monitoring in place? Do we really fully understand what's happening at the site? So given those site specifics, that would really push you to say, yes, it's under control, or no, it's not. If monitoring is not in place, then you can't select groundwater migration under control status. But let's talk more about the different categories and what the specifics are for each, now that we've gotten a little exercise out of the way. So there are four different groundwater migration determination categories, the first one being NA. If it's not a groundwater site, then you're not going to make a groundwater migration determination for that site, either because it doesn't have contaminated groundwater, or, you know, previous site conditions didn't warrant investigation or remediation of contaminated groundwater. Then we have insufficient data. So again, you don't have enough data to make the call. You have groundwater migration not under control. And what we want all our sites to get to, contaminated groundwater migration under control. So we're going to look at each of these in more detail. So what are the things you're looking for if you want your groundwater migration to be under control? Well, first you need to have sufficient information to make that determination. That means you have to fully understand your plumes, the full delineation of them both horizontally and vertically. How are they shaped? How are they moving? You need to be able to show that the plumes are not expanding, they're not changing in size or shape, and that they are stabilized. If you have a site and your plume is migrating across the site but not leaving the site boundary, guess what? Your groundwater migration is not under control. Like, you might want to argue, oh, but it's not, no one's exposed to it because it's on site, so it's fine. Well, that's not what this environmental indicator is looking at. It's looking at the migration of contaminated groundwater from within the original plume boundaries, not the facility boundary or the site boundary, but the plume boundary itself. That affected area of groundwater contamination, you want to ensure that it's not spreading. So that's, you know, one key difference with groundwater migration. And again, you want to make sure that you've looked to be able to answer the question as to whether or not there's any unacceptable groundwater discharges to surface water. And the other thing, the catch that we noted on the apply your understanding slide, is that do you have sufficient monitoring in place to confirm, in fact, that your plumes are stable and not migrating? That's very important as well. If you don't have a sufficiently developed monitoring network, then you really can't claim that your groundwater migration is under control for your site. Okay, so a few things to consider when you're doing your groundwater migration evaluation is that you're looking site-wide. You're looking at the distinct plumes across that site. As I mentioned, you want to look at the existing plume boundaries, not the facility boundaries, or not a projected exposure point somewhere downstream. You're looking at the plume boundaries itself. With MNA, monitored natural attenuation, if you have MNA that's part of a formal remedy that's been selected for a site, that can be used to verify that contaminated groundwater migration is under control. And it allows for some very limited amount of migration as long as it's within the MNA remedy, the expected behavior under that remedy. So I'll say that's the one like caveat, the one thing that you can consider when it comes to migration at your site. You can't preemptively say, oh, we're going to select MNA, so it's fine. No, it really needs to be identified as part of a formal remedy selection. And then, of course, make sure that you've evaluated whether groundwater discharge to surface water is occurring that level that pose an unacceptable risk. We have a migration worksheet for, groundwater migration worksheet for your use as well. Again, this is in your participant manual in a size you can actually read, and we're going to break it down into more user-friendly slides. So if you have a groundwater site, you'll start here. First question, does the site currently have contaminated groundwater? If not, then it's probably not a groundwater site and you don't have to proceed in making this EI determination. If yes, then you go to step one, which asks, based on the most current data, has all available information on known and reasonably suspected releases to groundwater been considered? If not, then you have insufficient data for that site. That would be your groundwater migration status. If you have sufficient data, then you would go to step two to answer this question, which is groundwater known or reasonably suspected to be contaminated above risk-based levels as a result of a release from the site? If no, then you can say your contaminated groundwater migration is under control. If you do have levels of contamination that are above risk-based levels, then you would continue to step three. And note in any of these steps, if you don't have enough data to answer the question, then your groundwater migration determination will be insufficient data. In question three, you ask, is the migration of contaminated groundwater stabilized? Is it expected to remain in that area of contaminated groundwater as defined by monitoring and locations? Again, you need the monitoring network in place. So if you don't have sufficient data, there you go. But if you say no, it's not stabilized, or no, it's not defined by monitoring locations, then your status would be here in the red, contaminated groundwater migration not under control. Let's go to the next step. So if you answered yes to question three, where you say, okay, is it stabilized and is it defined by monitoring locations? If you said yes to that question, then you would go to step four. Does contaminated groundwater discharge into surface water bodies? If you don't have sufficient data to answer that, then you go with insufficient data. But if you say no, it doesn't discharge to surface water, then you can skip to step six. But if you say yes, you go to step five and you ask, can the discharge of contaminated groundwater into surface water be shown to be currently acceptable, meaning it's not causing unacceptable impacts? If the answer to that is no, then your groundwater migration is not under control. If your answer to that is yes, you'll go to step six and then you ask, will groundwater monitoring be collected to verify that contaminated groundwater stays within the affected area? If you can answer yes to that, then you have contaminated groundwater migration under control. So hopefully that helped break down those, typical flowcharts that you see in government guidance documents. Just beginning to wrap up here, I want to talk a little bit about EI management practices. This is really focused at EPA RPMs who are dealing with EIs on an annual basis. You want to make sure that your management is involved at least sometime throughout the year in these discussions, particularly if you have human exposures not under control for a site. Making it part of the regular work schedule can be helpful as well. Getting management awareness as far as sites that have human exposures not under control or with insufficient data, remember those paragraphs are going to be uploaded and then available to the public. So your manager is probably going to want to know what's in there, because more than likely headquarters will be reaching out, EPA headquarters will be reaching out to ask what's going on with this site or why are we in this situation where human exposures are still potentially happening. There's a lot of tools out there. This webinar is one example. The EI guidance documents that we'll share at the end of the slides are really helpful as well, so make use of those. And we're going to round out this conversation in talking about how environmental indicators affect other CERCLA components for SWARU and five-year review. So why don't we switch gears and talk about those? These items are interrelated. If you have a change in your environmental indicator status, that may mean changes for other documents such as five-year reviews, your SWARU designation, site-wide ready for anticipated use, and risk determinations. So for five-year reviews, a lot of new information can come up during the five-year review process. There could be new exposure pathways, new contaminant sources. Maybe you have an emerging contaminant at your site. Or maybe you thought you knew what groundwater was doing, but it may be behaving very differently based on the data that you're seeing in your monitoring. So any of that new information can affect the determination that a remedy is functioning properly, and that may also affect if there's a potential for human exposure. So taking that information into account will be important. When you do a five-year review, check what your protective statements are and make sure that they are in step with your EI, your environmental indicator determination. If not, determine if you need to change your EI status in response to that new information that became available. The next component I want to talk about is SWARU. So, one second, here we go. Okay, slide 36. So this is another thing that we report to Congress, EPA reports to Congress. It's really high interest to EPA headquarters at this time, so you've probably already had someone reaching out asking about SWARU for your site. So in order to be able to ask for a SWARU designation, your human exposure, EI, needs to be that your protective remedies are in place or that long-term human health protection has been achieved. If you are at human exposures under control without that, you know, next two levels of protection, they are not eligible for SWARU. You need it to be those two highest levels where your protective remedy is in place or you have, in fact, achieved your cleanup level. So something to keep in mind. If you change your EI determination from long-term human health protection achieved to insufficient data, then that means that your SWARU designation would have to change as well. So in the regions, make sure you're talking to your five-year review coordinator, your SWARU coordinator, your environmental indicator coordinator in making a change. Sometimes that's the same person, so it's an easy conversation. If it's multiple people, reach out. If you're going to retract a SWARU designation, EPA headquarters is definitely going to want to be part of the conversation. So engage in those conversations early so it is a little easier across the board to have the conversation. As I mentioned with SWARUs, if site conditions change and you need to change your designation, don't be afraid to do that. If your five-year review, for example, finds that there's a new exposure pathway, and so now your EI is either human exposures not under control, maybe it's human exposures insufficient data, and you have to change at SWARU, don't be fearful to do that. This is a tool we use to communicate with the public about what our sites are doing, if there's any potential for exposure. So we want to be as open and honest as we can in these types of measures, because the whole point is to measure our progress in protecting human health and the environment. So if you have to make the change, that's okay. You can always change it back once all the appropriate requirements are again met. One more thing here with EI and risk determinations. Keep in mind, we've been talking about human exposures as an environmental indicator. This doesn't consider ecological receptors in any way. So again, an EI is not a full implementation of a Superfund remedy. Just keep it in mind that they're different. EIs are not meant to measure risk the way a baseline risk assessment does. They're, while somewhat complementary to each other, they are different things. So just keep that in mind when you're talking about EIs versus risk as determined through your CERCLA process for the site. Wrapping up here, we just want to have a quick list of the really helpful EI guidance and tools that are out there. The 2004 guidance is helpful. We updated it in 2008 with the human exposure revisions. These are EPA guidance documents. And the Superfund Program Implementation Manual, SPIM, that is the acronym I lost track of a little earlier today. This will have example language if you're trying to write your justification paragraphs for your EI determinations, and as we went over together, the human exposure dashboard, which is also available to the public. Just in summary, last slide from me for today is EIs are designated to communicate the progress we're making at our sites, our progress in protecting human health and the environment. They're important because these measures are tracked and then reported to Congress on an annual basis. So that's why EPA puts a lot of time and energy into developing tools and resources to help EPA RPMs in making these determinations. So make use of those tools and the appropriate contacts if you have questions or need help at your site. And keep in mind that there's interrelated components, environmental indicators, five-year reviews, SWARUs, all of those can impact each other. So have those conversations as early and as often as is needed when you're managing your sites. So we'll pause here for a second for questions, and we have a case study in once we're done with the Q&A, so we're not quite done yet, so don't go anywhere.
Okay, thank you. I'll just remind the audience, you can send in your questions and comments using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. And while we're waiting to see if anything else comes in, Emmy, we did have someone who commented earlier in the presentation when you were on slide 9. I think that's when you were talking about the Superfund Task Force. And they just wanted to know if that work had sort of broadened the scope of what CERCLA was looking at in its risk range. They basically said that EPA sometimes gets criticized for focusing on human health, like specifically when we're calculating CERCLA risk. And it seems like the task force may have kind of broadened that or gone beyond that in some of their work. Is EPA looking beyond just human health with this type of work?
So there were a number of task force recommendations. I can't remember if it was 40 or 60. So as far as the ones related to what we discussed today, that really was focusing on human exposures, not broadening it to also look at ecological risks in the context of environmental indicators. So as far as the one recommendation we discussed, I'd say no, the focus really is on protecting, you know, humans or people from human exposures to contamination, but there were a number of recommendations that just looked at how can we expedite cleanup, how can we get our remedies in place faster, more cost-effectively, so that we've achieved that long-term protection at our site. So I would say in the broader sense, yes, we want cleanup to progress more quickly, but as far as the recommendation we talked about today, that was still really focusing on human exposures.
Okay. And I don't see any other questions or comments that have come in just yet, although we did have some great interaction with the audience when we were going through those exercises. So I think perhaps in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and move on to the next presentation. So Laura, whenever you're ready, you can go ahead and call up your video. And I'll just remind the audience that they can actually move on with the presentation, but they still have that Q&A window in the lower corner. So if there were other questions and comments that pop up throughout today's session, whether it's on the case study or you think back to something that Emmy mentioned, you can continue to send your questions and comments on in using that Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. And so, Laura, whenever you are ready to begin, feel free to get started.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
All right. There. Presentation just finally popped up. So, yeah, I'm Laura Bulo. I've been an RPM out here at the Hanford office for 12 years now. So RPM the whole time. I've worked on Hanford the whole time, but I do get to work on other Superfund sites to keep my sanity besides just Hanford. But I was asked to talk about kind of from the RPM's perspective. So it's actually been good for me because I've learned a lot in working with Emmy on this of kind of the headquarters perspective on it, because from my perspective, it's worksheets that I get handed once a year and have to kind of look through and fill out with help of my management sometimes. So, let's see. There we go. I'm going to go through. We're going to kind of shift away from talking about performance measures for a bit and give you a break and look at some pretty or maybe not so pretty pictures of Hanford, but at least some background on the Hanford site. And while I'm giving a little bit of background, if people could kind of write in and say if you know what Hanford is, if you've worked on Hanford, if you've never heard of it before, and then I'll check back in with Jean. We actually have four different national priority listings. So in any talking about site-wide, that's based on the NPL listing, and we have four NPL listings at Hanford. So we get four sets of worksheets every year, and I'm in charge of two of those, two of the different areas, the 1100 area and the 100 area. And I will be talking through those of this is how I, as an RPM, get handed these worksheets and my kind of thought process and a little bit of what I refer back to determine if I have enough information. And then we'll have some time for questions at the end. So are you seeing anything about if people even know what Hanford is, if everybody's
yeah.
still awake up?
Yeah, they're out there, and most people have heard of it. A handful of people have actually visited it, but no one has worked on it, and some people have never even heard of it. So you've got a completely clean slate with some people.
All right, so nobody can call my bluff on this then. okay, so the Hanford site, to orient you, I'm going to call it the pointer. All right. So when you think of Washington State, if you've never been to Washington, you're probably thinking of the Pacific Northwest and the trees and the evergreen state that it's called, and that's this part of Washington. And then you go over the Cascades and you get to eastern Washington, and we are complete opposite. We are desert. We're shrub steppe desert. You cross the Columbia River bisects. So the Columbia River here goes all the way through. And that is the river coming in from the west, goes up and down the Horn, and then down, and eventually forms the border between Washington and Oregon. So Columbia River is an enormous part of the site. And when you cross the border here, there's an interstate, and that's how we come home a lot. We cross between Oregon and Washington, and it very seriously says, "Welcome to the Evergreen State." And all you see is sagebrush and wheat farms for as far as you can see. That is our habitat out here. We are 580 square miles throughout the entire site, and I'll give a little bit of rundown on what the processes were since it sounds like we have some beginners. So Hanford was developed during World War II for the production of plutonium for the bomb. That was its sole purpose. It was selected because of the Columbia River. Again, coming in here, we needed a huge amount of cold water. And it started out in the 300 area. So the 300 area in this area was where the uranium would come in, and they'd bring in uranium. They'd mill it into fuel rods in this area to go out to the reactors. The 300 area was also where the lab rats, they still call themselves that, developed all the processes that were then developed full scale. So everything was practiced in the 300 area first, and then you can imagine that for every procedure that actually worked, there were numerous ones that didn't work. So the 300 area is very close to the town of Richland. If you follow the river just a couple more miles, my house is right down here, so very close to the community. And a lot of that has been cleaned up. From that uranium that was milled into fuel rods would go out to the reactors. There's 9 plutonium-producing reactors. 8 of them, sole purpose was to produce plutonium. One of them, the last reactor that was built, the N reactor, was for power production and uranium. So those reactors, the fuel rods would go out there, would go into the reactors. The water would come from the river. They would treat it with an anti-corrosive, hexavalent chromium. It would go through millions of gallons a minute of the Columbia River were pumped through these reactors. It would then go to cooling basins along the river, and it would be allowed to both thermally and radiologically cool for a few hours before the water went back to the river. The fuel rods then were irradiated and then eventually taken from the reactors all along here. So there's 9 reactors all along the Horn. And then they were brought inland to this 200 area. So when the uranium if it was irradiated, only a small percentage of it actually turns into plutonium. And it takes a lot of really nasty chemical processes to separate out the plutonium from the rest of the uranium. And that, if you've heard of Hanford, you've probably heard a lot about our tanks and the tank waste and all the issues out there. And that is all in the Central Plateau. And that's from that processes, because eventually you'd end up with a puck about this size. That they called it a puck because it looked like a hockey puck of your solid plutonium. So we did a lot of cleanup along the 100 area. So these areas, we started our work along the river, 300 area, 100 area. We did a lot of work there, and then I've worked our way back into the Central Plateau, which is several miles back from the river and about 300 feet higher. So there is Hanford 101 in a couple minutes. We had, as I said, four different NPL listings, the three that I just described, and then the 1100 area down here that I will be talking about because it's a little bit different. It wasn't part of the production, but it did contain some of the support buildings, and then it actually had asbestos hazardous waste cleanup, and there's still an asbestos landfill there. Just a quick, so who we work with is the Department of Energy is the lead agency for cleanup out here at Hanford. And then EPA and Washington State Department of Ecology are the regulatory agencies that are all part of the tri-party agreement. Any of these federal facilities have generally called a federal facility agreement. You'll hear ours referred to as the TPA, tri-party agreement. The stakeholders that we work with, there's, get that out of the way. So there are three federally recognized tribes that we work closely with out here, and then there's the Wampum Band. It's not in and of itself federally recognized, but they were actually living out on site when they came in, because when they came in, they picked this area because it was pretty remote and because we had a lot of cold water and we had power from the newly constructed Grand Coulee Dam upriver. So there were some small groups of farming communities, and then the Wampum Band were actually living out on site, and they were all basically given a couple weeks and moderate compensation to get off the land, and the government took it over. The state of Oregon, as I mentioned, the Columbia River that cuts through eventually forms the border between Washington and Oregon, and therefore Department of Energy gives them funding to be involved because they are downriver. And then we have the largest advisory board in the DOE complex, the Hanford Advisory Board. It's made up of 32 separate seats, and they're in different interest groups. It's the tribes in Oregon that I mentioned, and then numerous other interest groups. And they're very active and very involved in the site. So here's the pretty pictures I promised. 40 years of production resulted in over 2,000 contaminated waste sites. About 1,700 contaminated facilities, about 200 square miles of contaminating groundwater, and 57 million gallons of highly radioactive waste in these 177 underground tanks. And if you've heard, as I mentioned, about Hanford, you usually hear about the tank waste. But what we do have is B reactor, which is the world's first full-scale plutonium reactor right here. This is the front face of it, and it's actually now part of the National Park Service. There's the Manhattan Park Historic, it's one of the historic parks, but it's operated by the National Park Service, and you can actually, it's free, but you need to make reservations ahead of time, and you can take the bus. I finally got to bring my whole family out to the B reactor that I've been working on, and I've been allowed to go in for the last 12 years, and they opened it up to public tours with no age restrictions. So you can actually stand right here in the front of the B reactor, and each little area in here is a separate place that they would put in the uranium fuel from the front. And then once it was irradiated, it got pushed out the back. And you would not be standing in the back. That's closed off. This is a picture of the tank waste taken remotely. And you can kind of see we still have quite a bit of that out there, and that's what makes the news. So the work completed to date, as I mentioned, the 1100 area has already been deleted from the national priority list. However, any of these sites that still do five-year reviews and we haven't met like full, they don't meet UUUE, which is unrestricted use, unlimited exposure. And a lot of our sites, anything that keeps waste in place with a cap on it is going to need 5-year reviews indefinitely, and that's the case for this site. So we still have to do environmental indicators on it. There was a partial deletion of the 100 areas along the river, and that was actually originally when it was listed. The stuff on the other side, the north and kind of the east of the river, were listed, and that didn't have much contamination, and that was able to be delisted. 1,300 waste sites have been cleaned up. 900 facilities have been demolished. And from those waste sites and the facilities, 18 million tons of contaminated soil went to our on-site landfill. It's a RCRA Subtitle C landfill, the Environmental Restoration and Disposal Facility. And then our pump and treat facilities, this is the one on 2S. Emmy is still the project manager for this. She still gets to keep her connection to Hanford. The pump and treat here, and then along the river corridor, there's pump and treats for hexavalent chromium and carbon TED in the Central Plateau, among other contaminants. So a huge amount of work that has been done on the site. Okay. So when I get these environmental indicators each year, besides just groaning about another administrative task, it is helpful to know how they are used. So this is the sheet that I get. And again, you're not intended to actually read through this. I'm going to break it down and zoom in. But I just wanted other people that are going to be getting these sheets to kind of know what it looks like when it's in your mailbox. And this is what I get handed once a year. So the first thing I do is I go and make sure that I know what I'm looking at. So I'm looking at human health versus groundwater. You kind of can figure it out when you start reading the questions, but they're not always, they look very similar. And you know, as I said, I've got two of these from Hanford. I work currently on three other Superfund sites. So I get five sets of these, so 10 total worksheets every year. And if you start trying to fly through them because maybe it wasn't your highest priority and now it's being asked for because the deadline's coming up, you want to make sure you know what you're working on. Hanford 1100 area. So we're going to go through this. Is there sufficient known and reliable information to make an evaluation on human exposure at the site? Well, let's go look. So the 1100 area, as I said, has been deleted from the NPL. So unless something new has come up, you better hope that there's enough information out there. And the best way, one of the documents I always like to go back to is the 5-year review. The most recent 5-year review was done in 2017. It was considered protective. This landfill is actually off public highway. I ride my bike out there on Sundays a lot, and this is where I just pulled off to get pictures of it to show what it looks like from the public highway. So you have your fences up, and there's actually institutional control to prevent the land from being used and dug into. The signs are still up. It says asbestos disposal site. There's a gate, so there's access road for Department of Energy to get in. Here's the gate. And the asbestos signs here. There's also our native tumbleweed to provide a secondary barrier compared to the barbed wire that's also keeping people out. So yes, there's sufficient known and reliable information there should be at this point in the project. Have all long-term human exposure-related cleanup goals been met for the entire site? And yes, this site, again, we'll look back at the deletion package, make sure that everything there has been done. I'll talk about groundwater. We look at groundwater too. And yes, this is one that actually does have long-term human health protection achieved. Which, when people say, oh, Hanford, you must never see any progress, we do see some progress here and there on specific projects. So I go through the worksheet on my own and go through and kind of circle these things and make sure that whatever I decided or whatever RPM I inherited the site from the previous year, I still agree with those statements. I go and see what I, going through it, would answer it as, and then check, make sure that it's what it currently is. The justification when you've been meeting these for a while apparently isn't as detailed because we've been getting away with a pretty basic justification ever since 2005 on this. So from here, turn the sheet over usually, and on the back is your contaminated groundwater sheet. That's what it looks like. Here's groundwater, and we're still in the same 1100 area. So the first question, does the site currently have contaminated groundwater, or did site conditions warrant EPA's investigation or remediation of groundwater contamination in the past? And yes, we did in the past look at groundwater contamination. Oh, based on the most current data on the site, have all available relevant significant information, known and reasonably suspected releases to groundwater been considered in this document? Yes, I looked back on everything and there's no new information that's come to light on this area in the last year. So is groundwater known or reasonably suspected to be contaminated above appropriately protective risk-based levels anywhere at or from the site? So let's take a look. This, again, is close to the city of Richland, the 1100 area. The Hanford site technically starts up here, and then you even get down into city property. These are wells that have traditionally been sampled for the 1100 area. The most recent sampling was in 2013 when we basically said that we had enough data at this point to say that the contaminant concern, TCE, was low enough. And this is not just based on this one sampling point. I want to make sure that that's clear. I would never base my determination off of one sampling point. But in 2013, this was the result. And we at that time decided that there had been enough data collected to determine that it was meeting the cleanup levels and would continue to meet it. So the answer to that is no, it's not contaminated above cleanup levels, so our contaminated groundwater migration is under control. And now that I'm highlighting this as a case study, this may change, but we haven't had any justification text, and I think that's because it is under control. If it was not under control, you better believe that headquarters would be coming back to me and saying, what is your justification and when is it going to get under control? So I'm going to just pause and check in. Jean, has anything come up, any particular questions about this?
No questions so far, but remember the audience will probably start sending some in, so you can feel free to move on and we'll pause again.
Sounds good. All right, so the 1100 area has been one that's been stable for the last, you know, since it was deleted from the NPL and then even kind of stopped monitoring for a lot of it. So that one is one that doesn't change. It would take something significant like a new contaminant or some other concern to change those levels, to change those results. But the 100 area along the reactor areas, there's a lot more interesting work going on there currently. So again, this is the worksheet that I get handed. And we're going to zoom in and start with human health protection and the 100 area. So the first question, is there sufficient known and reliable information? Oh yes, there is an enormous amount of information out there actually. If we've been doing this cleanup work for over 20, it started in 1995, so we have 24 years of information and identifying where the contamination is out there. Have all the long-term goals been met for the site? Nope, we've still got a ways to go, through my retirement at least. Are there complete exposure pathways between contaminated groundwater, soil, surface water, sediment, or air media, and human receptors such that exposures can be reasonably expected under current conditions? Now, I bet if I polled people and asked, is Hanford causing, you know, potential for human exposures, that I don't have a poll, but I'm going to guess that most of you would probably say, well, yes, anybody that knows about Hanford, you know, we're billed as the most contaminated Superfund site in the Western Hemisphere. So, but it's not that easy. So let's take a look at what we go through to see if anybody is reasonably expected to be exposed. So Hanford has these extensive site controls. This is as you're approaching the site, you see this warning, basically like your whole vehicle is going to be has potential to be inspected, prohibited items. You go through a guard station to get to the 100 areas. Now, there are other areas that you can access from the public highway, but those are all posted. This posting is all along the Columbia River every couple hundred feet and along the public highway. before you get out on site where there's areas. And then we also have Hanford Patrol out there patrolling and making sure that nobody is out there. For the people that do work on there, we all go through extensive training, and that's refreshed annually. And then workers that are out there are monitored. What else do we do? Washington State Department of Health radiation monitoring. They monitor air, they monitor groundwater, surface water, and drinking water, and then they also monitor farm food, fish, wildlife, and plants. And they provide this annual summary report out to the public about what the results show, and they show that people are not being exposed. The other thing we've done is we did an enormous risk assessment along the Columbia River. Besides this annual monitoring and the monitoring on site, we did an enormous risk assessment about 10 years ago that looked at surface water, sediment, island soils, fish, all through upriver. So this is the site in Brown. We went upriver to see what the levels were. We sampled all the way through the site, and then we sampled downriver to see what was going on. And from that, the abiotic material were within risk range. It was safe for recreational use. The risks that we saw were due to fish consumption, and that was the same upriver and downriver, and it was PCBs and mercury, and it was fairly consistent with what we've seen elsewhere in the state. There was no levels of exceedances through the Hanford site, and PCBs and mercury aren't actually something that we typically see elevated as a result from Hanford, at least not getting into the river. So from all of that, we actually say there aren't complete human exposure pathways through the 100 area. We haven't seen if we don't get regular trespassers out there. Hanford Patrol spots anybody pretty quickly that's taken a wrong turn. We don't have just general members of the public trying to come up from the river. There's a lot of use on the river, but we don't see use of it out there. And even if they were to cross kind of the line onto the DUE site, you'd actually have to get really close to some of the waste sites to have complete human exposure. So our answer is no, which takes us down to this next step. And is the site construction complete? So we're down here. Is it construction complete? Is the remedy operating and intended? I don't even have to go past the first part of this that says, is the site construction complete? Because my answer is no. But if it was, you'd have to look to see if it's remedy operating as intended. And nope, we're not construction complete. So we are current human exposure controlled. Go back up to the top. And yep, we're controlled. And again, our justification for things that are controlled are not nearly as in-depth as they would be if it was not controlled. Okay, last one. Thanks for hanging in there. This is the 100 area groundwater form. So groundwater, 100 areas. Does the site currently have contaminated groundwater? Yes, we can just stop right there and say, yes. Based on the current data on the site, have all available relevant information known and reasonably suspected releases to groundwater be considered in this EI determination? We have done an enormous amount of groundwater sampling out in the 100 areas to define the plumes, determine remedies. We've had interim remedies. We have some final remedies. We do have an enormous amount of information. So yes. Is groundwater known or reasonably suspected to be contaminated above appropriately protective risk-based levels anywhere at or from the site? Let's go look. These are our plumes just of 100 areas. Hexavalent chromium is one of our main contaminants, and that is what you see actually. This light brown and dark brown are both different levels of hexavalent chromium. And this is what Amy was saying, like, when we have the whole site. So I can tell you these are all multiple operable units. We have, I forget what the number was on the first slide, dozens of operable units. Like this area has 3 operable units. This has another 3. So here at like the K area, our groundwater, we have a pump and treat remedy. It's treating the hexavalent chromium. We're not hitting the river above the cleanup standard for hexavalent chromium of 10 micrograms per liter. So there's no discharges to surface water above standards. Same thing with the DNH area. We have pump and treat there. The N area is meeting it for hexavalent chromium, but it has a little bit of issue with strontium-90. And the BC area has a few areas that it's actually hitting the river above the cleanup standard for hexavalent chromium. We don't have a pump and treat system there. So even though they're fully delineated, and most actually of the operable units are not hitting the river, discharging to surface water above standards, there are some that are. And therefore, the whole determination gets said, yes, it's above, let me get that out of the way, risk-based standards, and the migration is not under control. So we say no there. We go down here, contaminated groundwater migration not under control. So you go back up to the top. Our justification date hasn't actually changed because it's been the same thing, is that contaminated groundwater is still being discharged to the river above standards. And it's that the expansion, or for us, it's discharged to the river that's keeping it from there. So with that, as I said, we have four different NPL sites, so four different sets. We just walked through the 100 area and 1100 area. The 200 area is the Central Plateau of Hanford, and that is same for human exposure and the same for groundwater, actually. The plumes there are expanding. There is pump and treat going on for some of it, but in some areas the plumes are expanding, so it's not under control. The 300 area, the one closest to Richland, the groundwater is actually under control, no longer hitting the river above standards and not expanding. So it hasn't met all of its cleanup levels yet, but it's under control. So with that, thanks for hanging in there. We've got some time now. This is actually the elk herd from the Hanford site. I was told that there was an elk herd out there for the first few years that I worked out on site, and I was starting to think that people were just messing with me, because there's a couple different routes you can head out to the reactor areas. And I get out there and people would say, oh, did you see that elk herd? I'm like, no. And they're like, oh, take the river route. So I take the river route home and I wouldn't see the elk herd. And they're like, no, take the Central Plateau route out next time. So I take that route. And after this, I just figured that they were messing with me. But about 3 or 4 years into driving crazy around, driving crazy routes around the site to try to see the elk, I finally got to see some of the elk herd. And it is a beautiful herd that we have out there.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We did get a number of specific questions, Laura, for this site. So I'm going to start with those, and then I'll open it up to some of the broader questions and then have you come back on the line, Emmy, to help with those. And then for the rest of the audience, if you haven't sent your question or comment in, remember you can continue to do that using the Q&A window that you should see in the bottom right corner of your screen. So the first thing is, we actually had someone who had commented earlier that they were working on the site, and they just made a clarification that the 100 BC area is strontium-90, not uranium. And I don't know if you can comment on that or no.
It's actually hexavalent chromium. The 100 BC area has hexavalent chromium. The colors were a little weird. It was supposed to be the darker brown, and it's back at the site.
Okay.
The darker brown just indicated higher levels of hexavalent chromium. There's
okay.
I don't think that matters as much.
Okay. But we did have a question about the hex chrome, and someone was looking at the map, I believe, that you had up, which was showing some of those areas that were impacted. They wanted to know, where exactly did the 10 microgram per liter hex chrome limit determination come from?
The 10 that we use is the, I think, a 10 is the state standard for aquatics. 11 is the ambient water quality criteria. So those are the standards that are ARARs in our interim record of decision, for and some final records of decision that were came from the ambient water quality criteria. So actually, hexavalent chromium is the drinking water standard in the state of Washington is 48. So the water criteria is actually the lowest for hexavalent chromium.
Okay, and someone just chimed in and said they liked your pun that you had with the elk herd versus herd in that last slide. So they did catch the pun there.
I'll pretend that I meant to do that and it wasn't just a really bad typo.
Noted. So we did have another question about the frequency with which you're conducting the Columbia River Risk Assessment. They just wanted to know, how often do you do that? Is that part of CERCLA or NEPA, or are you using some other statutory authority when you're doing those risk assessments?
So that was a CERCLA risk assessment, and that was, I would say, a one-time risk assessment. We did a full remedial investigation to kind of determine if the Columbia River should be its own operable unit. And it's not the only time we sample the river, though. That's why I mentioned, like, the Department of Health goes out every year and does actually kind of more real-time monitoring. And then we did that as kind of a one big investigation starting in about 2009 to 2011 is when we did it, to see if there's anything out there in sediments or behind the dams or anything else that we should be looking at as a separate operable unit. And what we concluded from that is, no, it didn't justify being its own operable unit. And we needed, basically, the effects that we didn't see effects, but the contamination that we saw was down in the hyperreic zone coming out from groundwater, and those were going to be addressed by the individual operable units of where that groundwater came from. So we didn't have to go out. But there's continual sampling that's been done, but not to the extent that we did during that RI.
Okay. All right, and so there were some questions about the form, the sample forms that you had popping up on the screen where you were sort of walking through your determination. One of the participants wanted to know if you had to justify your response, or were you allowed to just put yes or no when you're filling that form out?
Generally, we get away with yes or no, and Emmy can probably maybe chime in here too, what she sees from headquarters. But if it's insufficient data, then it's usually a when are you going to get that data and when. If it's just a yes or no, then no, they're not looking for a full, they don't necessarily need links to all the documents. They're not double checking that we know how to do our jobs. So it's not that intense. That's maybe more in a conversation with your manager, that your manager, because they have to sign off on this also, that they're comfortable that you've looked at everything and didn't just, you know, completely blow it off until the last second and ignore it. But headquarters isn't making us provide, like, a huge amount of references or anything else.
Yes. Okay. Laura, I think you hit on it just right. So remember, as I mentioned, after the task force really put this environmental indicators for human exposures in the spotlight, that was starting in 2017, all this additional attention was focused on environmental indicators. So before that, really simple justifications were not heavily looked at, but now anything that's human exposure, insufficient data, or not under control, definitely are asking for full justification paragraphs that say why that is and how it's going to be addressed. So that, I would say, that's recently new asks from the RPMs in the past year or so.
Okay. And I think you also mentioned, Laura, some other people had been asking about the reference documents, because in those screenshots you were showing, there was a space to put yes or no and then a space to put your reference documents. And they just wanted to know, do you fill that part out, and what are the types of reference documents that you would include when you're completing that section?
So the reference documents that I would include is 5-year reviews are something you go back to a lot. If you're in the middle of your remedial investigation, Hanford does an annual groundwater monitoring report that kind of summarizes all of the groundwater data, and that's basically where I go to. I mean, most of these, the sites that I'm working on closely enough, I know where all the most current data is, but the groundwater report is a great one to identify. So if you have either a groundwater report that's sent from your site on an annual, a lot of times, like on my other non-Hanford sites, my PRP has to provide me with an annual summary of the groundwater data. That's a great one to reference. RI, anything under RDRA, too, that you may end up with of just annual monitoring. One of my other sites has annual monitoring, long-term monitoring report that they have to do annually, and I go back to that a lot. That's required under your RDRA work plan. Those are the type of documents I go to look for to look for all the data.
Okay.
I will say, go ahead.
Go ahead. You can finish that one, and then we'll move on to some broader questions.
I will say, like, Hanford is maybe, and I hate to even say this out loud, but we don't have any historical use of perfluorinated compounds, PFAS, but I think PFAS and coming up is one thing that's changing a lot. I do have it on some of my other sites, and one of my other sites that all of a sudden you go from you think everything's under control to, oh, no, we found PFAS emerging contaminant in the groundwater. Oh, no, now we don't know how far it is or where is it. That, I think, is throwing a lot of these into chaos. And, Emmy, are you seeing that at the national level?
Absolutely. There's a lot of conversations going about on how we incorporate emerging contaminants like PFAS into our five-year review protectiveness statements, into our environmental indicators. When do you say it's insufficient data? So a lot of conversations going on about that right now.
Okay. And so, Emmy, if you want to come back on camera, go right ahead, and we'll move to these sort of broader style questions. And it might be nice to do a tandem response, both headquarters and the region. This first question is looking at the indicators in the CERCLA five-year review process. So they would like to know if EPA is intending to apply the indicators as part of a five-year review.
So while the environmental indicators are interrelated with five-year reviews, they're not incorporated into it. So ideally, you have a requirement, likely a statutory requirement, to do a five-year review at your site. You do that. You come and determine what your protectiveness statements are, and then given that information and any information that was considered during the five-year review process in your annual evaluation of environmental indicators, you're going to want to look at that same information. The protectiveness statement itself is likely not going to provide all the information you need. You need to look at the data itself or any other reports, new information that's come to light, and consider that in making your EI determination, going through the flow charts that we went through to identify, you know, are there pathways, are these new contaminants going to change your environmental indicator status? So I would say they're related, but your five-year review process is its own process, but you want to make sure that same information is being considered in your EI determination process as well, which happens more often because that's annual and our five-year reviews are, well, every 5 years.
Yeah, I'll say that I just finished up a five-year review, and I don't really go back to the EI worksheets when I'm looking at my five-year review. That is a separate process. But when I look at my EI worksheets every year, then I am going back to the five-year review for the justification.
Okay. Okay. And then there's a question about the phrase reasonable. One of the participants would like you to elaborate on that application of, quote, reasonable. And it's part of a number of the EIs. They want to know what the rule of thumb is when you are, quote, reasonable. Are we trying to stay consistent across the country? Could you perhaps give them some examples of what others have used to make it, quote, reasonable?
Sure. So reasonable, I'll admit that's a bit of a loaded word, right? Because that can mean different things to different people. But when you're dealing with groundwater migration, I feel reasonable has a higher bar because you actually need to have data for whatever conclusions you're going to make, particularly if you're saying that groundwater migration is under control. So reasonable there, the level of certainty has to be higher. You need to have information you can point at. When it comes to human exposures, I feel that the bar for reasonable is different because you might not have a full baseline risk assessment conducted to point at. You might not have a fully vetted out conceptual site model to look at. So the level of certainty uncertainty is higher when making your EI determination for human exposures than it is when you have fully conducted your baseline risk assessment and have all that data to look at. In that case, remember, the whole goal is to identify whether or not there's a potential for human exposures at these sites. when you say reasonable, if you can reasonably expect that the community or others who might be exposed will actually be exposed to contamination, then it makes sense to identify that site as human exposures not under control. Unfortunately, there's not a specific definition or criteria that I can point to because it is so site-specific.
Okay. And this, I don't know if you guys are aware of any, but someone wanted to know if there were court rulings that sort of set a precedent regarding the definition of reasonable.
Not as far as I'm aware, but I'm not an attorney. I would have to check with our legal groups to see if so. Nothing comes to mind. I don't believe the courts have been involved in environmental indicator determination.
Okay.
Let's hope it stays that way.
This one is actually from RCRA. So the individual wants to know if RCRA corrective action programs use something similar to EIs. Do they have a dashboard like the Superfund program does? They're trying to find that kind of data, and it hasn't been as easy for them to find.
So, yes, I should have specified that earlier. We are looking at environmental indicators under CERCLA. RCRA also has environmental indicators that it conducts. I don't believe there's a dashboard for our RCRA sites, though, that you could easily gather that information from. And the worksheets and the guidance for the RCRA sites is different than what we've discussed today under CERCLA.
Okay. I'll just remind the audience we have another moment here to go ahead and send in some questions and comments. But Emmy, while we're waiting to see if there are any other outstanding questions or comments, where would the participants find the worksheets that you were talking about that Laura was walking us through?
So if you have your participant manual handy, the very last slide in there should, or near the end of the slide, should have hyperlinks to those documents, the 2004 guidance, the 2008 guidance worksheets are included in those. So I would take advantage of that manual, click on those links, and the first one, I forget how many pages it is. I know the 2008 guidance is 80 pages, so it's a bit lengthy. That's why we provided the hyperlinks instead of going over the entire document.
Okay. And I'm seeing some messages of people saying thank you and they appreciate the time. Take that back. Here we go. Somebody wanted to know, going back to that concept of a dashboard, have you heard any talk? Is there going to be a type of dashboard created?
A dashboard for the RCRA environmental indicators?
Yeah,
I have heard nothing as far as that discussion. That was really prompted under our Superfund program because of the task force, the Superfund task force. I don't believe RCRA has a similar initiative at this time, so I have heard zero rumors about that being extended to the RCRA program.
Okay. What about NEPA? She just commented that there is a dashboard similar to this for NEPA, and I didn't know if you were familiar with that dashboard.
I am not familiar with the NEPA dashboard. Laura, are you at all familiar with it?
Mm-mm.
No. Sorry, can't speak to that one.
Okay. All right. I don't see any other questions or comments in the queue right now. Wait a minute. So we're just getting thank yous for just responding to questions. I'm seeing some other logistics questions about certificates, and we will get to that information here in just a moment. But before I sort of change gears and go to our closeout reminders, I wanted to offer our speakers an opportunity for any last reminders or comments that they wanted to leave you with. So, Laura, I'll ask you first. Any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
Nope, I don't think so. Thank you.
Okay, and Emmy, how about you?
Sure. I just want to remind everybody, and especially my EPA folks in the regions, you should have an EI coordinator at your region that you can reach out to if you have questions. I am the EI coordinator for our federal facilities program, so if anyone has questions about EIs at a federal facility site, please feel free to contact me. I'd be happy to engage in any conversation or answer any questions that you might have.
All right, fantastic. Well, with that, let me walk us through some final reminders and go ahead and start answering those logistics questions that are coming in. You guys are getting a bunch of thank you messages from the remote audience. They just wanted to thank you for your time and your expertise, so I wanted to be sure to relay that to you. I also want to thank the over 220 people who joined us live for today's broadcast. We had a great turnout today, so we appreciate those of you who joined us for today's session. And I want to thank both of our instructors for taking time out of their days to share their expertise with you. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material, you'll find that on the seminar resources page. So Emmy noted a number of links to other guidance, to the participant manual. All of that is already posted. So if you look on the middle of your screen on the right under related URLs, there is a button to something called seminar resources. If you click that, that should take you to a page where you can download or access the resources that were highlighted today. If you're looking for contact information for your presenters, they'll also find that on that seminar homepage as well. And I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Now, for those of you who are looking for a certificate for joining us today, you can get one. All you need to do is fill out an online feedback form. So if you follow the link to the seminar feedback form and fill that in, making sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you were here for the whole thing and make sure your email address is in that form correctly, once you submit it, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. For those of you that join together in groups, each one of you can fill out that feedback form on your own, even if you didn't register individually. So you'll simply need to get the link to the feedback form from the person who signed up, and then you can complete that on your own and get your own certificate as an individual participant. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's session, you can still access those links under related URLs and send in a feedback form to get your own certificate based off of replaying the archive. So we'll get you an email out in about a week or so as soon as this archive is available for on-demand playback. And with that, I will go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.